Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
What do you think the odds are that Florida will have some kind of a gambling agreement this year?
With the no casino limits on the ballot and a likelihood of it passing, now more than ever, it's crucial that we discuss a compact with the Florida House and the tribe.
Also tonight, the House version of Florida's budget drops support for a therapy that seems effective against opioid addiction.
This funding goes away, all these things we've set in place and hope to do are just going to be non-existent.
We'll also get the latest on state government's attempt to help deal with this winter's horrific flu season and also hear about the lack of affordable housing that's causing a problem because of all the immigrants coming in from Puerto Rico. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the start of week six in the 2018 Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. While the Florida House and Senate have both declared gambling positions that seem at odds with one another, the two sides are continuing to work to move closer together. We get the latest from Regan McCarthy.
A Senate committee amended its chamber's gambling bill Monday to move the measure closer to an overhaul proposal released by the House. Palm Coast Republican Senator Travis Hudson is carrying the measure. He says it now includes a 20-year extension of the state's gambling agreement, or compact, with the Seminole Indian tribe.
I would like to point out that the Florida House does not have the craps and roulette provision, but they do have the compact. We take up the House's position on eliminating dormant and unused permits. We take up the House's position on designated pre-reveal games, designating them as slot machines.
Hudson says the Senate is hoping to find common ground with the House on four key issues.
That is the reduction of taxation on slots from 35 to 25% over 2 years, legalizing fantasy sports, authorizing designated player games, and then lastly, it allows for decoupling.
Hudson says the Senate is motivated to get a gambling measure passed this year before a proposed constitutional amendment hands any future casino expansion decisions over to the voting public.
With the no casino limits on the ballot and a likelihood of it passing, now more than ever, it's crucial that we discuss a compact with the Florida House and the tribe. This could be our last possible chance to regulate gaming as a legislative body. And I need not remind anyone on this committee, the fiscal implication is within the hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
One of the biggest points of contention in most gambling talks is the issue of decoupling. The House measure does not contemplate the move, but that raises concerns for many animal rights activists who complain greyhounds used at tracks are not well cared for. On the other hand, members of the thoroughbred horse industry insist decoupling would tank an industry essential to the state of Florida. The Senate had given paramutuals the option to decouple or continue offering other types of games without the requirement to hold races. But Hudson has amended his measure so decoupling is not allowed for thoroughbred tracks or highlife frontons. But Mark Dunbar, a gambling lawyer with the Jones Walker Law Firm and a lobbyist for the Stronach Group, a horse track operator, says the plan might still hurt the thoroughbred industry.
How decoupling works is critical to whether or not the Florida racing, thoroughbred racing industry survives and thrives after this legislation passes.
Dunbar says under the measure, paramutuals that continue holding races will be negatively impacted because the purse available for races will shrink dramatically.
For the Florida bred horse that races here in the summer, if we do not have a vibrant and robust purse pool, they're not going to continue to be able to race here, and we're not going to continue to be able to breed here.
Dunbar is also concerned about a provision that would not allow a casino damaged by a hurricane to relocate. Others raised concerns about the measure equating an expansion in gambling, something House Speaker Richard Corcoran says is a non-starter in his chamber. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The opioid crisis keeps growing in Florida, and here's one person who deals with it literally every working day.
Patrick Lane, and I'm a nurse and a counselor at Disc Village. We are a behavioral health and substance abuse program in Tallahassee. We have prevention programs and drug treatment programs that serve the Big Bend area.
And even in this part of the world, Lane says treatment centers like his are seeing the opioid situation getting steadily worse.
We certainly are. We're not West Virginia or Northern Pennsylvania yet. I think that yet is kind of an important comment. But we certainly are seeing an uprise in the number of people with opiate addiction. We're seeing a rise in children being placed in foster care because parents either pass away or because of their addiction can't properly care for their children.
The other component of the opioid crisis, Lane says, is how lethal these substances are. Certainly, drugs like crack cocaine and even alcohol can kill, but he says opioids, especially the street variety, are in a whole different league. There is, however, a treatment that seems to help.
Vivitrol is actually a once-a-month injection, and it's designed to help with cravings and operate as a blocker for opiates. It also helps some with alcohol as well, but using it primarily with people with opiates.
Lane insists the effectiveness of Vivitrol isn't merely his opinion.
Patients are telling me that they find this medicine very helpful, and you know, we don't sell it as a magic bullet. It isn't that. But, you know, when we're looking at a disease that's very complex, the more options people have, you know, the more likely they are to get clean and stay clean.
Lane says it was actually a bit of a surprise to him and other treatment and recovery professionals around Florida when the state started providing the funding to make Vivitrol available to programs like his.
We as a state have not been honestly that progressive when it comes to battling addiction, and this was kind of a big step that I think a lot of providers and people in the community were excited about, that we're kind of treating this as a brain disease and our medications that help, and that we're kind of getting away from simplistic ideas of just say no and just need to have will and these kind of things that just aren't accurate when it comes to addiction. It's a very complicated process.
State government numbers seem to reinforce Lane's anecdotal success stories. For the 2 years leading up to this past November, just over 1,000 patients under the supervision of the Florida Department of Children and Families received one or more Vivitrol injections. More than 3 out of 4 of those saw successful outcomes, according to DCF. Similar positive numbers came out of the state's criminal justice patient population, which is why Lane says the therapy has been steadily gaining a foothold in local lockups, too.
We just got a program started with the Leon County Jail, so we can give some injections in the jail for people who are interested in getting them Vivitrol. And are reaching out to other jails, you know, in other counties in the near future. And so if this funding goes away, all these things we've set in place and hope to do are just going to be non-existent.
And that funding elimination is now a real possibility. The House budget rolled out last week does away with support for both the DCF and Corrections Vivitrol programs. Lane says the only way clients like his would continue to have access to the medication is essentially on their own dime.
Probably a small portion of people that maybe have insurance that might, and I want to say might, be willing to pay for it. Not all insurances do. It's not that recognized. And so the vast majority of my patients would not be able to continue on Vivitrol if they wanted to.
Lane says that would put those and thousands of others in Florida recovering from opioid addiction at risk for relapse. Remember the old song by Chicago, "Does anybody really know what time it is? Does anybody really care?" Well, there was lots of caring going on concerning time in the Florida legislature today. Most of the panhandle would remain an hour behind the rest of the state under a revamped Senate proposal that would seek congressional approval to put Florida on year-round daylight savings time. The Commerce and Tourism Committee voted unanimously today to support a bill that would keep Floridians from having to reset their clocks twice a year. Before the vote, bill sponsor Greg Stube, Republican of Sarasota, removed a provision that would have placed all of the state in the Eastern time zone, noting that people in Northwest Florida objected to switching from Central time. One of the loudest voices in opposition came from Committee Chair Bill Monford, a Tallahassee Democrat whose massive 11-county district includes land in both time zones. The change in the Senate bill makes it nearly identical to the House version, which swept through a pair of committees and is set to go to the full House by midweek. If approved by the legislature, the proposal to shift to year-round daylight savings time would depend on the final say of Congress. Still to come on Capitol Report, with a severe flu season, lawmakers grapple with whether to allow pharmacists to test for the flu.
If you're not feeling well, then you don't have to schedule an appointment with your doctor. You can run into the pharmacy, get a swab real quick, and they'll be able to tell you whether it's the flu, and then refer you to the physician if it's not and you still feel unwell. So,
Florida lawmakers urged the state legislature to address the affordable housing crisis caused by the mass migration of Puerto Rican refugees to Florida.
We stand for our brothers and sisters from the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico that have been treated as a second-class citizens and continue suffering without our basic resources.
And to bean or not to bean? That is the question before state lawmakers after one local government outlaws front yard vegetable gardens.
Just the sheer fact that they have a garden should stand. That is an American, as I believe, as apple pie.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
A legislative effort to allow pharmacists to issue flu tests to sick Floridians is on hold for now. As Sasha Cordner reports, it comes at a time when health officials say this year's flu season is just as bad as the swine flu epidemic that happened nearly a decade ago.
Already in Florida, there have been more than 300 flu outbreaks so far, and 14 people have died from the flu. And given the severe flu season, St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandes says he wants to help address that.
This legislation has the ability to save lives and provide access to treatment for Floridians unable to see a physician. According to the Department of Health, Florida has seen more flu outbreaks reported this year than in previous seasons.
So he filed a bill to allow pharmacists to test and treat for the flu that's in line with what physicians do. Brandon says that's similar to what's in place now for immunizations.
To be eligible to test and treat, the pharmacist must complete a certification program, maintain at least $200,000 of professional liability insurance, maintain the patient records for at least 5 years after treatment, use a testing system that meets federal standards and integrates the certified electronic health record technology, provides the results of the test to the doctor designated by the patient, and report the existence of the disease of public health significance to the Department of Health.
Brandes's bill previously allowed pharmacists to test for flu and strep throat infections, but he narrowed the bill to just the flu. And while Florida physician groups approve of the change, they still oppose the measure. Dr. Michael Forstoffel represents the Florida Medical Association. He says pharmacists don't have the proper training to make the right diagnosis.
Flu itself doesn't kill people. It's the complications of pneumonia, of the flu, that like pneumonia or the risk that puts them for heart disease, that kill people. And this is what, in my opinion, a pharmacist is not trained to screen out. If somebody comes to the pharmacist and tests positive for the flu, they say, oh, I got the flu. They go home. When they really have pneumonia, they're not getting appropriate treatment.
And Brandis's measure also received pushback from his fellow colleagues. While she says she's not questioning the good work pharmacists do, Port Orange Republican Senator Dorothy Hugel says she can't support the bill.
The bill clearly changes the scope of practice with regard to diagnosing, testing, and treating. And I understand how we want people to receive treatment. However, we are giving the right to certain persons who have not been trained to do things that they have not been trained for. And I think that ultimately that does a disservice to the public.
Fort Myers Republican Senator Elizabeth Beniquisto says she, too, has a problem with the bill, since the person going to the pharmacist
could be a complete stranger to the pharmacist. The pharmacist may not know their medical history, not know anything about their lives. They walk in. They have the simple test, and then it's that simple that I could do it. You just know they're going to be able to prescribe the Tamiflu. They're not going to go to the doctor. And without benefit of that patient's medical history, their ongoing chronic health concerns, it concerns me that the Tamiflu might not be enough or not be able to help get that individual through what is about with a flu with their ongoing chronic medical conditions. And that's where I have a problem with it, because the flu is becoming so severe.
But some pharmacist groups say this practice is already going on in other states, and pharmacists are trained in patient assessment. And they say this bill doesn't prevent those people from going to the doctor. Florida Retail Federation's Melissa Rambo represents all of the pharmacy chains in the state.
This would give access to care. It is a simple test. And the Tamiflu is best use is within 48 hours of the first symptom. I don't know about you, but my first symptom doesn't send me directly to the doctor. What this bill doesn't do, it doesn't prohibit anyone to go to their doctor. If I got the flu test and they gave me Tamiflu and it wasn't working, I'd probably still go to the doctor. I'd take my child to the doctor. I would not just depend on this one test from a machine.
Meanwhile, Brandis says he has decided to put the bill on hold for now, but he adds he's not giving up and he's planning to work on some of the lawmakers' concerns and bring the measure back in the future. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Amidst the aftermath of Hurricane Maria's devastating effects on Puerto Rico, Florida lawmakers believe the state has been inactive when tackling the issue of Puerto Rican refugees. This has opened the floodgates for an issue Florida has been dealing with for years, as we hear from Andrew Quintana.
The aftermath of Hurricane Irma and Maria has created an immigration crisis in Florida. Congressman Darren Soto is urging Florida to take a page from Washington, D.C.
With these major challenges, we saw a historic budget where Democrats and Republicans came together in Washington to pass real solutions. Even though we couldn't get the Dreamers on, we must continue to fight for them. Tallahassee needs to take a page from that book and work together on issues that unite us rather than divide us.
Soto is pushing for greater support for Puerto Ricans who have moved to Florida following the storms. The destruction caused by Hurricane Maria on the island has forced tens of thousands of Puerto Rican citizens to resettle in Florida. Soto says this influx of refugees has exposed a housing issue that Florida has been struggling with for years.
There would be a huge mistake, a huge missed opportunity, should we fail to have an investment of $309 million in the Sadowski Fund for affordable housing. This is, yes, about an influx of tens of thousands of folks from the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, but that's made it to a tipping point in areas that already had a huge need for affordable housing.
The $300 million Soto mentions is a budget plan for the Sadowski Trust Fund proposed by the Senate. Over the last decade, the trust fund has had over $1 billion swept from it in order to plug the state's budgetary holes. The House's latest budget plan would continue that trend, as it diverts $182 million from the trust fund. House Speaker Richard Corcoran explains the reasoning behind the sweep.
Well, again, it's just a prioritization. You know, we got to fund our law enforcement. We have to fund our K-12 system. The Senate's putting a great emphasis on funding the higher educational system.
The sweeping of funds has spiked the cost of living in Florida. The University of Florida Schimburg Center reported that 744,662 low-income renters spent more than 40% of their earnings on housing in 2015. 35% more than a decade ago. This has led many lawmakers, like House Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith, to label the affordable housing situation a crisis that has been exacerbated with the recent introduction of Puerto Rican refugees.
The crisis has been exacerbated by evacuees from Puerto Rico, from the Virgin Islands, who, as of right now, might not have anywhere to go next week. Because next week, the TSA program expires, a FEMA program that lets them use vouchers to stay in temporary hotels.
He says the sweeping trend will take years to recover from.
It's going to take years because year after year after year, we do the same thing here in the legislature. We sweep the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We put ourselves deeper and deeper into this hole. And so what is the solution this year? After all of this has come to its worst fruition imaginable, with Puerto Ricans sleeping in cars in Orlando because they have nowhere else to go, we're raiding the Affordable Housing Trust Fund again.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ange Quintana.
A former Homestead mayor wants the Florida Supreme Court to take up a challenge to his conviction. The case involves consulting work on a permitting issue for a nonprofit organization. Stephen Bateman filed a notice last week in which he asked the High Court to hear the case after the Third District Court of Appeal upheld his conviction back in December. That's according to documents posted today on the Supreme Court's website. As is common, the notice didn't go into all the details of arguments Bateman will make to the Supremes. Bateman's lawyers had tried to make the case before the appeals court that he should be acquitted on a charge of unlawful compensation or reward for exerting influence on another official's behavior, and a charge of violating a Miami-Dade County lobbyist registration ordinance. Bateman was indicted after an investigation that focused on his efforts while serving as mayor to convince Miami-Dade County to speed up a permitting process for a sewer pumping station in Homestead. Bateman had entered into a consulting agreement with the nonprofit Community Health of South Florida, which wanted the permit approved so it could move forward with building a children's crisis center. After a jury convicted Bateman on two charges, he was sentenced to nearly 2 years in prison. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the state's highest court will not weigh in on Floridians' right to a front yard vegetable garden, but Kate Payne reports the food fight isn't over in the state capitol.
On a small corner lot in a tree-lined neighborhood in Tallahassee, one resident is growing a ton of peppers.
This is sweet banana. Yeah, this is the best food in the world. It's best food. They have vitamin C pound per pound more than anything in the world. This sweet banana.
Zilphy Barty's front yard is full of them. When WFSU spoke with him in 2016, there was no lawn to speak of, just rows and rows of bushes covered in hundreds of peppers. A bill moving in the legislature would protect Barty's right to do exactly what he's doing, grow vegetables in the front yard.
Just the sheer fact that they have a garden should stand. That is an American, as apple pie.
Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean is co-sponsoring a bill that would prevent local governments from outlawing front yard vegetable gardens.
That tomato, if it's homegrown in your front yard, is threatened by our courts. Because just a few months ago, the Third District Court of Appeals has said Floridians don't have a right to have a garden in their front yard. That's what we've come to. That's what we've come to. Homegrown gardens are outlawed.
This comes after the village of Miami Shores forced a local couple to uproot their garden or pay fines. Fausto Gomez represents the town.
Resident had a vegetable garden in his front yard. Not an issue. That resident then expanded the vegetable garden to include all of his front yard and the swale, which is the public property as well. That became an issue at that moment because other residents in the neighborhood, zoned R1 residential, said we basically don't want to live in an agricultural area.
He says the town wants to maintain a certain aesthetic. Local ordinances regulate the size of decorative landscaping stones residents can use. Meanwhile, David Cruz with the Florida League of Cities is concerned about public health issues and
competing private property rights concerns. And obviously, I think that the goal here is that we want to maintain property values high at the local level.
Bill supporters jokingly paint opponents as anti-vegetable and anti-American, with a vendetta against homegrown tomatoes. But in all seriousness, Longwood Republican Senator David Simmons thinks the bill language still needs some work. He says lawmakers should
still give to the local governments the ability to reasonably regulate but not prohibit. Taking into consideration that I doubt that any one of us in many of our neighborhoods would hate to have an entire front yard, for example, done as a garden that's got corn that's 10 feet high.
Private property rights and the preemption of local control cause plenty of headaches in the state capitol. But lawmakers aren't taking this issue too seriously. Committee hearings are usually pretty stuffy and procedural, but the debate on this bill has been unusually good-natured, even funny. Here's Bean again.
Members, this is a great sign. I just looked down. The bill number, 1776. It's America. So stand with America. Stand with Senator Bradley. Let's join together and say we are preserving our country's core values, and that's the right to grow our own food.
The state Supreme Court has turned down the opportunity to hear the Miami Shores case. That means the town's ordinances are safe for now. But lawmakers say they're still dedicated to protecting Floridians' right to garden. They're even turning to food puns. Lead sponsor Senator Rob Bradley tweeted this week, "I will keep fighting, kumquat May." The bill has one more committee stop before it goes to the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Andrew Quintana and our sister operation, the Florida Channel. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2018 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. A resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.